It's
okay.
Hear me out. It's the way the Jedi just don't see. I mean, obviously we have foresight because we've seen all the episodes and movies, but they just can't see that Palpatine is like the master. They can figure out everything else, but they're literally chilling in Bro's office, and it's like everything's just too convenient. So like it's.
Well, I think the way I kind of like rationalized it for myself is like he's just a politician, so they're gonna get bad vibes from him, right?
Yeah.
And so they're thinking, oh, the bad vibes are just from the fact that he's a scumbag politician, not from the fact that he's a Sith Lord. So honestly, that was really smart of him.
It was smart of him. It's just I love the Clone Wars to death. It's just like we were watching some Beth and I watch the Clone Wars pretty often right now. And it's just like, fuck, I wish they could see it.
You need to read the book Darth Plagueis. It is
Darth amazing. Plagueis.
That was Palpatine's master, wasn't he?
Yes. And it explains a lot of stuff.
Okay. I will definitely. Is there an audiobook of this?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's on Audible.
I'm sure. It might even be like one of like the full cast ones.
Definitely will be doing
no,
that.
No, I don't think there is one like that, but it's like they're
reading a series right now. It's got like a full cast, and it's very interesting how different it is from like the other books I've listened to.
Is it a Star Wars book?
No, it's Red Rising.
Oh, okay.
Pretty good. I'd recommend the series. But
foreshadowing, we'll get into that later.
Well, gentlemen, we've been recording for about 5 minutes now.
Shall 2 minutes and 6 seconds, actually. Yeah, that's right.
Fuck me, you actually paid attention for once.
I know, right? It's fucking crazy. I just looked over when you started talking, so.
Oh, well, shall we get this shit started then, shall we?
I think we should.
Well, welcome to the Micro Machines podcast. This week, we shall be talking about HMS Dreadnought, possibly one of the most important battleships ever to be made, purely because of the impact it had. Although, in reality, like combat-wise, it didn't have too much of an impact, but the mere presence and its creation created one hell of a shockwave throughout the wars and all of that. Well, just throughout production and shit like that. So, before we get started, we shall do some introductions. So you have me, Callum, from New Zealand, drinking a very nice ginger beer, no matter what the other ones say. It also makes it a lot nicer when you add a shot of vodka into it, so things will get spicy.
All right, I'll give you props for that. Well, you got me, Garrison, out here in Kansas, working on some figures and drinking a fresh pot of coffee, as always.
You got me, Clint, out in Indiana, and you'll never guess it, I got a Pepsi.
Oh, holy shit.
And I am Grayson. I am in Iowa, and after about a year of absence, I am back, fuckers, and I got coffee as well.
My man.
About fucking time.
Welcome back.
Right, so this week, talking about HMS Dreadnought, and we'll find out just why the Dreadnought was such an important battleship. But before, of course, there were ships before the Dreadnought, and these ended up actually being called pre-Dreadnought ships just because of just how much of an impact the design for HMS Dreadnought created. So we have four examples here. We have HMS Dominion, HMS Agamemnon, USS Massachusetts, and the SMS Radiketsy, whatever. Fucking Russian. So, pre-Dreadnought battleships, constructed from the 1880s to the early 1900s, preceded the revolutionary HMS Dreadnought of 1906. Initially known simply as battleships or by rank-specific terms like first-class battleship, they supplanted the ironclad ships of the 1870s and 1880s as the dominant warships of their era. The 1890s marked a shift towards standardized designs, notably influenced by the Royal Navy's Majestic class, with these vessels featuring steel construction, compound or hardened steel armor, and coal-fired boilers powering reciprocating steam engines driving underwater screws. These battleships were characterized by their main batteries of heavy guns in rotating mounts on the weather deck, often armored, complemented by secondary batteries of lighter guns. The increasing uniformity in battleship appearance during this period reflected the global proliferation of these vessels. Rising naval powers such as Germany, Japan, and the United States, alongside established forces like the United Kingdom, France, and Russia, expanded their fleets with pre-dreadnoughts. The peak of pre-dreadnought naval warfare culminated in the decisive Battle of Tsushima on May 27, 1905, between the Imperial Japanese Navy and the Imperial Russian Navy. The arrival of HMS Dreadnought in 1906 rendered existing battleships obsolete almost overnight. Dreadnought epitomized the shift in battleship design towards heavier, longer-range guns with her all-big-gun armament of 10 12-inch guns. Her groundbreaking steam turbine engines also provided greater speed. This technological leap decisively outclassed existing battleships, leading to a succession of designs following their format. Henceforth, new battleships were larger and more powerful, fittingly named dreadnoughts. This marked the moment when previously laid down ships were retrospectively termed pre-dreadnoughts. So the idea of these battleships at the start were you had a couple of big heavy guns for long range, but they were mainly for trying to smash through the belt armor and, you know, trying to hit below the waterline and stuff like that. And what these battleships would do is they're still in the age of long-range naval warfare. It still wasn't quite there. So they would still get up and close, you know, within, you know, viewing range, as it were. And hence these still large but smaller secondaries were used to try and rip apart other ships whilst the main batteries would try and go through the armor, you know, sort of a all these complementary guns to go with and had specific roles. However, there was a lot of times where the splash from the secondaries was so great that they couldn't sight in for the main guns or anything like that. And of course, these compared to Dreadnought and later on everything that came after, these are still quite lightly armed. Of course, you know, only having the two twin main turrets and stuff like that. So they're like literally the impact of Dreadnought was overnight. The minute Dreadnought was released into the ocean, everything was obsolete. Like, doesn't matter what it wasn't. Oh, maybe with this, it was anything, any battleship before Dreadnought was completely obsolete. Like, say HMS Agamemnon, right? That was part of a Lord Nelson class, and they were building two of those at the same time as Dreadnought. Dreadnought came out first, and literally they didn't even, I don't think they bothered. I think they might have finished the two ships they were building, but they were obsolete, like, before they even hit the water. That's the impact that Dreadnought made.
So I will could say, you say that Dreadnought was not just a technological jump, but, like, an entire doctrinal shift? It was, yes, that like impactful.
Yes, Dreadnought now focused more on longer range, you know, out of sight sort of battles now, you know, heavier armor, heavier guns, not getting up close. So whereas these battleships, they had to get up close to do what they were supposed to do.
So essentially Dreadnought was like the biggest bitch on the block and nobody could touch him.
Pretty much. It's like the same as, like, say, everyone flying biplanes and then suddenly a low-wing monoplane comes out with a better engine. That sort of thing, you know?
Okay, gotcha.
I will say, though, these pre-dreadnoughts, they do look pretty cool. They have a little bit of class to their design. All right. So now we have dreadnought development. So Admiral Fisher proposed multiple battleship designs featuring consistent armament in the early 1900s. In early 1904, he assembled an informal advisory group to help determine the optimal specifications. Upon becoming first Sea Lord, which is a fucking awesome title to have.
Sea Lord?
Yes.
That's like something from Helldivers. What the fuck? I love it.
It's like, I am the first Sea Lord, thank you. God, I would so make people use that title every time they talk to me.
Fucking Sea Lord. Aye, Sea Lord or some shit.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, upon becoming first Sea Lord on October 20th, 1904, Fisher successfully advocated within the Board of Admiralty for the next battleship to be armed with 12-inch guns and maintain a speed of at least 21 knots. In January 1905, he established a committee on designs, which included members from his advisory group. This committee was tasked with evaluating proposed designs and aiding in the detailed design process. Although ostensibly independent, the committee primarily validated decisions already made by the Admiralty, shielding Fisher and the board from potential criticism. Fisher personally appointed all committee members and served as its president. The committee concluded its designs by January 18, 1905, settling on the arrangement of the main armament without superfiring positions due to concerns over muzzle blast affecting open sighting hoods on lower turret roofs. So initially they didn't want to stack turrets like you see later. I think one of them was also they didn't think that there would be the high amounts would be strong enough. So hence why you see more turrets on the main deck. Which, nice. You know, for that time period is, you know, a legitimate concern in a way.
So at this time period, 21 knots, that'd be like a fucking spaceship at the time.
That's yeah, 21 knots is very fast. Like, especially
the boys in the coal room were fucking cooking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that because that was quite interesting how they powered it.
Cool.
Now, where was it? They also opted for turbine propulsion over reciprocating engines, which saved 1,100 long tons in total displacement. Additional deliberations before disbanding on February 22nd included determining the number of shafts, considered up to six, defining the anti-torpedo boat armament, and crucially, incorporating longitudinal bulkheads to safeguard magazines and shell rooms against underwater explosions. Something that's a very good idea if you're going to be storing a large amount of explosives. Because yeah, we've all seen like what happens idea. When they get hit. HMS Hood. Yeah, that's what happened to the HMS Hood with the Bismarck. Armor-piercing shell went right through the top into the magazine and detonated, and hence why out of a crew of over 1,000, three people survived.
Some might call that a significant emotional event.
That's got to be some crazy survivor's guilt.
So this decision stemmed from observations during the Russo-Japanese War, where the Russian battleship Tsarevich reportedly benefited from heavy internal bulkheads after a torpedo hit. There's also a movie depicting the Russo-Japanese War during that battle, and I really want to find it. I've only seen scenes on it on YouTube. I really want to find it because it looks really well done.
I did not know this.
Yeah, I know.
But you don't know the name?
Nope. It's just, you know, when you go on YouTube and you just find random movie scenes from war movies, and it doesn't even show, like, and it looks really good, and it's like, what the fuck is this?
And nobody fucking knows and nobody says anything. Yeah, it's really annoying.
Yeah.
Because the Japanese kicked the Russians' ass at that war.
Oh, the Japanese decimated the Russian fucking fleet, and they never really recovered afterwards.
Yeah.
Following their final session on February 22nd, 1905, the committee reported their findings in March of that year. Due to the innovative aspects of the design, orders for other ships were postponed until the completion of HMS Dreadnought and her trials. The finalized hull form underwent rigorous testing at the Admiralty's experimental ship tank in Gosport, requiring several iterations before the optimal shape was determined. Once finalized, a team of three assistant engineers and 13 draftsmen proceeded detailed drawings. To expedite construction, the internal hull structure was simplified and efforts were made to standardize on a limited variety of steel plates differing only in thickness. I will say HMS Dreadnought is a very good-looking ship as well. Like, they get style points as well.
Oh, yeah. Good-looking ship.
Armament. The fun things. So, Dreadnought was armed with 10 45 caliber BL 12-inch Mark 10 guns housed in five twin Mark B... B8 turrets. I'm a little bit slow on Roman numerals. Position centrally the forward turret, or A turret, and the two aft turrets, X and Y, lined the ship's axis, while two wing turrets, P and Q, flanked the forward superstructure on port and starboard sides. Capable of delivering a broadside from 60 to 50 degrees aft of the beam, Dreadnought could also fire six guns astern and four forward beyond these angles. However, firing within 1 degree ahead or astern risks damaging the superstructure due to the blast effects. So basically you're blasting your shells across the weather deck, which is no bueno. Oh, it's just, especially with wooden decks, will just shred all the wood across that. So these guns could depress to minus 3 degrees and elevate to plus 13.5 degrees, firing 850-pound or 390-kilogram shells at a muzzle velocity of 2,725 feet per second or 831 meters a second, which is fucking humming, especially for that amount of weight. This armament provided a maximum range of 16,450 yards or 15,040 meters with two with armor-piercing shells, extending to 18,850 yards or 17,240 meters with more aerodynamic AP shells, albeit slightly heavier. The guns maintained a fire rate of approximately 2 rounds per minute, supported by a complement of 80 rounds per gun aboard the ship. That is a lot of explosives.
Now, in that bottom picture there, what are them things in front of the guns?
These things?
Yeah, is that down to the ammo room for them, or what is that?
No, because these are 12-pounder guns mounted on top of the turrets. Those are the open sights for the turrets.
Oh, okay. I see what I'm looking at now. I thought that was on deck.
That's the coincidence, Strange Hunter.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm seeing. I was trying to figure out what I was looking at there.
Yeah, these are the original range.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck are those?
Yeah, because these are the early range finders, not the ones that are on either side of the turret, which makes life easier. These are open sights.
Yeah, they almost look like, you know, stairwells down to like the casemate or something.
Mm.
So, okay, I can see it now.
Okay, so that's the secondary armor guns, which originally Dreadnought's secondary guns comprised of 27 50 caliber quick firing 3-inch or 76 millimeter 12-pounder. Jesus Christ, there's a lot of bloody info. 18 CWT Mark I guns, which are these, as you can see here. These guns had an elevation range from minus 10 to plus 20, firing 12.5-pound projectiles at a muzzle velocity of 2,660 feet per second, with a fire rate of 20 rounds per minute. Each gun was supplied with 300 rounds. Initially, 8 guns on the forecastle and quarterdeck were planned to be stowed on deck chocks during daylight to protect them from muzzle blasts. However, trials in December 1906 showed that this was impractical, leading to relocation of 2 port forecastle guns and 1 outer starboard quarterdeck gun to turret roofs, equipping each turret with 2 guns. By the end of 1907, the remaining forecastle guns and 1 outer quarterdeck gun were removed, reducing the total to 24 guns. During the refit in April to May of 1915, the two guns from the roof of A turret were reinstated on the starboard quarterdeck. Later in 1906, 2 guns after the superstructure were removed, leaving 22 guns. 2 quarterdeck guns were fitted with high-angle mounts for anti-aircraft duties, and in 1917, 2 guns adjacent to the conning tower were also removed. In 1915, a pair of quick-firing 6-pounder Hotchkiss anti-aircraft guns were installed on high-angle mounts on the quarterdeck with a maximum elevation of plus 60 degrees and a shell fired at 1,765 feet per second. These were replaced in 1916 by quick-firing 3-inch Mark II high-angle guns, capable of a maximum elevation of 90 degrees, which that'll be cool to see, and firing a 12.5-pound shell at 2,517 feet per second with a rate of 29 rounds per minute, an effective ceiling of 23,500 feet. Additionally, Dreadnought carried five 18-inch or 450mm submerged torpedo tubes, two on each broadside and one on the stern, with a total of 23 torpedoes. Six 14-inch torpedoes were also provided in her stem picket boats. You'll be happy to know that all torpedoes on battleships were removed after the war, because it turns out torpedoes, battleships don't really work. For a torpedo, you have to be well within the other battleship's gun range.
So you're like within knife fighting range in comparison.
Yeah, if your battleship is already that close to another one, shit's gone wrong anyway.
But it did stop the Japanese from fucking around with the idea on their cruisers.
Oh yeah, yeah. Or the have you heard of HMS Eagle? One of the carriers England was building.
No,
it was a battleship conversion, and they had one anti-aircraft cannon and 18 torpedo tubes.
Holy fuck!
Why not?
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah. What's that naval guy that Drakenoff? Yeah. However you pronounce it. What did he call it? I remember I was watching an episode and he said, they decided to add more AA cannons onto it and remove God's torpedo barrage. So these mountings, the 12-pounders, originally they were for torpedo boats, because those were big during the First World War, especially because destroyers had torpedoes, but they weren't as effective. Torpedo boats were kind of the go-to. Then later on, destroyers started to get better and better, and you ended up replacing all the torpedo boats. But originally, these quickfires, they were for those kind of things. Because also, yeah, the quickfires weren't that good against the destroyers as well. But, yeah, it was a practice that they got rid of. I mean, they still kept secondaries, but they ended up being used for different things. Ugh, right. Hang on, just need to take a sip here.
I just want to say that ship looks hot. Like that angle right there.
Oh, yeah. Like, whoever took that photo, Jesus Christ, they nailed it.
You're like, you know they're out there on that little fucking pontoon boat where the fuck they're on. They're like, yep, I got it. It's like perfectly angle.
Yeah. I gotta say as well, for a photo that's taken from between 1906 to 1920, well, not even that.
On the water, that.
On the water, that is a high definition photo. Like that is
very nice.
Like, yeah, that's a better photo than I've ever taken. You see why I like the Dreadnought? It's just such a nice looking ship.
Understandable, yes.
Okay, propulsion, because we've all got to get somewhere. Vickers, Sons, and Maxim, all names of machine guns, by the way, served as the primary contractor for Dreadnought's machinery. Although lacking expertise in large turbines, they entrusted Parsons with their procurement. Notably, Dreadnought pioneered the adoption of turbines, replacing older reciprocating triple expansion steam engines. Her propulsion system featured two sets of direct drive turbines, each driving a pair of 18-foot, 10-inch diameter, three-bladed propellers. Steam was supplied by 18 Babcock and Wilcox boilers, operating at 250 psi. The turbines were rated at 23,000 shaft horsepower, aiming for a top speed of 21 knots. During sea trials in October 9th, 1906, Dreadnought achieved 21.6 knots. Dreadnought carried 2,868 long tons of coal, an additional 1,120 long tons of fuel oil that was to be sprayed on the coal to increase burn rate. At full capacity, she could steam for 6,620 nautical miles, that's about 7,620 standard miles, at a speed of 10 knots or 19 kilometers or 12 miles per hour. So she was quick for her time.
Definitely cooking.
It's interesting, though, that they sprayed oil onto the coal just to make it burn a bit faster as well. That was pretty cool. Didn't know that. All right, we'll get into some of the technical things, the fire control, because, of course, you've got, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 turrets, and all the secondaries, you've got to sort of, you know how to aim it, know how to control it. So, Dreadnought represented an early implementation of advanced fire control instruments within the Royal Navy. Featuring electric transmission of range, order, and deflection data to its turrets. Control stations for the main armament were situated in the spotting top atop the foremast and on a platform atop the signal tower. Each station utilized a 9-foot bar and Stroud FQ2 rangefinder, feeding data into a Duramisk mechanical computer, what you see right here on the left. This information was electrically relayed to Vickers range clocks down here in the transmitting stations located below deck, converting it into usable data for the guns. Voice pipes maintained communication between these stations. To enhance resilience, upgrades were implemented following the firing trials in 1907 against HMS Hero, during which the spotting top was hit twice, severing the voice pipe and wiring along the mast. During refits in 1912 and 13, improvements included gyro-stabilized mounts for rangefinders, additional installations on turrets, and the introduction of a Mark I dryer fire control table in the main transmitting station. Advancements in fire control technology continued rapidly leading up to World War I, notably with the introduction of the director firing system. Initially tested on Dreadnought in 1909, but later removed due to operational concerns, preparations for a production director began during the ship's refit in May and June of 1915. By April-June 1916, every turret was equipped with a 9-foot rangefinder, with the director likely installed during this period, marking a significant evolution in naval warfare capabilities. So, yeah, when Dreadnought comes out, like, she is loaded. She is, like, the most advanced thing on the water at that time. She's got everything you can find that's, like, new and whatnot. She was kind of a test bed in a way.
So she actually hit HMS Hero during firing trials? Is that what you said?
Yep, seems like it.
Huh.
Probably just used as a target.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. I thought you meant like how they did ship drills during World War II, where they would, you know, have a known offset and they would just straddle the ships.
I'm not that sure. I might need to do a bit more research into that. All right. Construction. Dreadnought was named after its 5 predecessors in the Royal Navy, the name symbolizing Fear Nothing, which is a fucking awesome name, I gotta say.
See, you got fucking, what was that name earlier for the fucking dude?
First Sea Lord.
Sea Lord, and then Fear Nothing. Yeah, this thing's swinging his fucking cock around.
The Royal Navy know how to name stuff.
That's fair.
That's her cock, Garrison.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Right, to meet Admiral Fisher's ambitious timeline of completing the ship within a year, which is fucking impressive.
Damn.
Extensive preparation began in May 1905, with about 6,000 man-weeks of work done during formal laying down on October 2nd, 1905. Constructed at His Majesty's Dockyard of Portsmouth, known for its rapid shipbuilding capabilities, the project was shielded from public scrutiny. Efforts were made to downplay its innovative design. Initially, 1,100 workers were employed, quickly escalating to 3,000. While previous ships adhered to a 48-hour work week, laborers on Dreadnought endured a demanding 69-hour, 6-day schedule from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., with compulsory overtime and brief lunch break. Attempts to introduce double shifts to alleviate stress were hampered by labor shortages. On day 6, or October the 7th, construction had begun with bulkheads and middle deck beams, and by day 20, the bow and hull plating were well underway. That kind of sounds like a standard American work week.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate, honestly.
Some things never change. By day 55, upper deck beams were in place, and by day 83, upper deck plates had been installed, with construction of the hull completed by day 125. Dreadnought was christened by King Edward VII on February 10th, 1906, using Irvine Sparkling Australian Wine. Blech. And the launch, originally planned as a festive occasion, was subdued due to mourning in the royal court. Someone had died, apparently. Also, apparently, it took about 3 or 4 or about 7 attempts with the bottle to actually break it. bit of a fail.
Well, when you use shitty fucking alcohol like that, the ship's sitting there thinking, like, yeah, I'm not going to let you break this shit on me. That's not how we're doing this.
Post-launch, the ship underwent fitting at number 15 dock. Estimates of the ship's construction cost vary, with figures citing as £1,785,000 £1,785,000 to £1,623,000, which anyone want to try and make that into modern terms? What it would be?
I'm not from the fucking tea land, so I don't know.
You have fucking Google.
Yeah, well, I'm painting, so.
Let me try to.
Clint to the rescue.
Let me see if I can find a thing here.
Thanks, buddy.
Google.
Wow. While Clint looks us up, have you guys seen the fucking video where it's like an old man, he's like typing into Google, and it's on Google's website, and he keeps putting in google.com, and he keeps getting mad because he gets the same page load up, but it's Google. This shit's fucking hilarious.
Okay, first I gotta... Okay, pounds inflation calculator. Here we go.
Whew.
Okay, what number you want me to put in here? The biggest one?
Let's go for the biggest one, yeah.
1,785,683.
How much would HMS Dreadnought cost nowadays?
This is telling me that it's 272,102,811.65 pounds, or whatever their pennies are.
What's the pound to USD ratio?
We'd also have to do inflation on that. This says an average inflation rate of 4.317 per year.
Let's see. So what was it? What did you calculate it out to in pounds?
272 million.
272. Yeah.
102,000.
Yeah.
811. And yep. 65 pennies.
So that in freedoms is 344,468,554.41.
You know what? I honestly thought it'd be more than that.
Yeah, I really did too.
Well, let's see here. What's that a difference of?
In half bed, honestly.
How much does a modern ship cost? That's...
Oh, probably fucking way more than that.
It's got to. It's got to be in the billions.
Actually, that's only a 935 pound difference.
Huh.
Or, sorry, 935,000 pound difference.
I was about to say, there's no way.
Oh, I forgot I didn't put in the change there.
All right, so, Dreadnought. She was expensive.
Oh, yeah. At the time, what people was getting lucky to get, a pound a day, probably?
Oh, I wouldn't even get that. That would be a pound a month. Okay, trials. On October 1st, 1906, Dreadnought raised steam and embarked on sea trials at Devonport, just a year and a day after construction. So they built that in a year. That's ridiculous.
That's actually insane.
You know how long it takes to get shit done around here nowadays?
Technology makes everything 10 times longer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you got that stupid health and safety stuff you gotta do now.
Who the fuck needs that shit?
Fucking OSHA.
And employee benefits and, you know.
Well, pay time off and fucking lunch and breaks.
Giving people somewhat livable wages.
Can't use fucking child labor anymore.
This fucking world's gone downhill.
You guys just described your current employment statuses.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we're up here.
I mean, maybe you guys. I'm pretty happy with mine.
I'm leaving my job, going to a new one, so it's getting better.
Okay. 2 days later, she undertook comprehensive trials of Polperro, weird name, on the Cornwall coast, reaching an average of 20.05 knots and 21 knots on the measured mile during her 8-hour full power contractor trials on October 9th. Returning to Portsmouth, she underwent further trials involving her guns and torpedoes before completing her final outfitting. Commissioned into the fleet on December 11, 1906, she entered service 15 months after being laid down. Claims that her construction was expedited by using guns or turrets originally intended for the Lord Nelson-class ships preceded her unsubstantiated, as these components were not ordered until July 1905. It's more likely that Dreadnought's turrets and guns were simply received higher priorities than those for the earlier ships. Dreadnought departed for the Mediterranean Sea on December 1906 for extensive trials, stopping at Arosa Bay, Gibraltar, and Golfo di Aracini, whatever, before crossing the Atlantic to Port of Spain, Trinidad, in 1907. She returned to Portsmouth on March 23, 1907. Captain Reginald Bacon, another cool name, Fisher's former naval assistant and a member of the Committee on Designs, conducted rigorous tests of her engines and guns during this cruise. His report noted no member of the Committee on Designs dared to hope that all the innovations introduced would have turned out as successfully as they had been in the case. On this voyage, she maintained an average speed of 17 knots between Gibraltar and Trinidad and 19 from Trinidad to Portsmouth, demonstrating unprecedented high-speed performance. The shakedown cruise identified several issues addressed in subsequent refits, including the replacement of steering engines and the installation of cooling machinery to lower temperatures in her magazines, crucial for preserving cordite integrity. However, a significant unresolved issue throughout her service life was the placement of her foremast behind the forward turret, behind the forward tunnel, exposing the spotting top to the hot exhaust gases and compromising her combat effectiveness. Basically, the poor bastards up here are getting choked out by the stack.
Yeah, that was an oversight, wasn't it?
That's a little bit of a fuck up.
And I think it also had to do with the heat coming off of it. Like, it was interfering with the... like the binos and the scopes that are also up there.
Oh, that would definitely. You'd have the heat wave, haze, and all of that.
The shimmer, I think, also was a part of it.
And then also just raw dogging all the carcinogens that are coming up.
Oh, yeah.
I can't breathe, sir.
Then again, the guys up there are probably chain smoking fucking rollies unfiltered all day, so they probably didn't even notice.
You know what? Yeah, you're probably right.
They were probably smoking way worse stuff than what was coming out of the stack. Okay, so the career of Dreadnought, which for all the hype up we've been doing, her career wasn't much at all. So
talk about blue balling.
Oh, dude. From 1907 to 1911, Dreadnought served as the flagship of the Royal Navy's home fleet. In 1910, she gained notoriety during the Dreadnought hoax orchestrated by Horace de Vercole. Cole, known for his pranks, arranged a group disguised as Abyssinian royals to tour the ship, including figures like Virginia Woolf and members of the Bloomsbury group dressed in blackface. This incident highlighted Dreadnought's status as a symbol of Britain's naval power. She was replaced as flagship of the home fleet by Neptune in March 1911 and subsequently joined the 1st Division of the home fleet. Dreadnought participated in King George V's Coronation Fleet Review in June 1911. Later, in December 1912, she became flagship of the 4th Battle Squadron after being transferred from the 1st Battle Squadron, and she trained in the Mediterranean from September to December 1913. At the outbreak of World War I in 1914, Dreadnought was stationed at Scapa Flow as flagship of the 4th Battle Squadron in the North Sea. She was relieved of this duty December 10, 1914 by Benbow. Despite her primary role as a battleship, her notable action during the war was the intentional ramming and sinking of the German submarine SMU-29 in the Pentland Firth in March 18, 1915. This incident marked her as the only battleship to deliberately sink an enemy submarine. She also almost hit another battleship that was trying to do the same thing. And of course, the bow of Dreadnought is a ramming bow. This is the time where that was still a viable option. And so her bow was designed to ram things. And reportedly, it literally cleaved SMU-29 in half.
Like, so you could say the Dreadnought liked to pay.
Jesus.
They were still doing like Roman type shit then with this.
Oh, you just know that captain got off on that one. It's just like, I just rammed a ship.
Dude, imagine the impact if you're like in the lower decks of the Dreadnought and you just slam into a fucking sub. Holy shit.
Well, by the sounds of it, you wouldn't have noticed it just by what it did to it.
Well, I mean, like, the tonnage difference. Like, those submarines are, what, maybe 1,000 tons at the high end, and you got, I forget how many tons this thing was, but, like, it would have been, like, a speed bump.
Yeah, it's like, what was that?
All right, fair enough.
Didn't even scratch the paint.
Yeah.
Following a reefer at Portsmouth from April 18th to June 22, 1916, Dreadnought missed the Battle of Jutland on May 31st, the largest naval engagement of the war. She subsequently served as flagship of the 3rd Battle Squadron from July 9th, 1916, stationed at Sheerness on the Thames, tasked with countering potential shore bombardments from German battlecruisers. During this period, she engaged German aircraft with their AA guns on their way to London. Returning to the Grand Fleet in 1918, God, that sounds like something from Star Wars, being part of the Grand Fleet, she resumed her role as flagship for the 4th Battle Squadron, but was decommissioned on April 7th, 1918. Recommissioned as the Tender Hercules on February 25th, 1919, to serve as a parent ship for the reserve, Dreadnought was eventually sold for scrap May 9th, 1921, to Thos W. Ward. She was broken up at Ward's facility in Scotland upon arrival January 2nd, 1923. Few artifacts from Dreadnought have survived, with one notable exception being a gun tompion preserved at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. So a bit of a disappointing end to a very important ship.
A little bit.
So, I mean, during her whole career, I mean, what, she just sunk the one submarine?
Yep, that's it. Damn. And shot down aircraft.
I mean, what was the German Navy going to do? Fight it? They would have died.
Well, yeah, I mean, after the Jutland, Battle of Jutland, then yeah, the German Navy didn't have much after that. But no, I think she was being refit during the time, so it was just timing, really. Yeah. If she wasn't in the refit, she definitely would have been a part of that.
And then just to be recommissioned as a tender, what was a coal? She a coal tender or? Ammo tender?
Sure, the whole tender is, I think it's like just tender and it's whatever they can get, really. I'm not that sure.
That's actually a very sad end.
So, what exactly does the tender do again?
It's basically just a carrier. You know, just
a resupply ship.
The bitch ship.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
I mean, it's a very important ship, but yeah, a bitch ship.
Yeah.
I mean, bogues are important, but they're bogues.
I was out there, Marine. Settle down.
But like going from like the first of the most important steps in battleship, you know, history to that is a bit, yeah,
coal carrier,
underwhelming.
Oh yeah, and we have some models that you can build of HMS Dreadnought. Of course, we have one from Avell and 350.
People made models of these. It's crazy.
Yeah, of course they did.
Who builds scale models?
Fucking nerds.
So in 350 scale, we have one from Revell, one from Zvezda, and 350 from Trumpeter. You have the 1907 fit out. And in 1 to 700 is Trumpeter again with the 1918 fit out. So slight differences between them. But, me, myself, I'd be more inclined for the 1907 fit out because it's just the early version of it. And that's it for HMS Dreadnought. We're about
to have it. That's very nice.
Hope you guys learned something. It wasn't too boring.
No, that was actually really interesting. I'm not a big ship guy, but that was interesting.
Have you guys ever heard of the game Dreadnoughts? Dreadnoughts?
No.
It's pretty cheap, I think. I've got it. But it's basically like a ship builder. Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts. It's kind
of
like
I've heard of that one. Yeah.
Super fun. Like you get a bunch of these like historical hulls, and you can design your own ships and you gotta make them work. It's really fun.
Sounds like something Callum would play.
Yeah.
Probably would, but at the moment it would probably melt my laptop.
No, it's actually pretty easy to play.
It's about like Minecraft.
I mean, it's not like, I wouldn't say it's low poly, but it's not like
super high. Are you calling Minecraft low quality?
Low poly, not quality.
Okay.
Which is the whole point of the game, by the way, is being low poly.
It's high quality, low necessity to run.
But actually,
Minecraft takes a lot to run.
Yeah, it does. Like, if you do too much, that will melt stuff.
Whatever.
But that is it for HMS Dreadnought. I hope you guys learned something. We're about to have an intermission now. Then we will be back with the hobby news, whoops, and a brand new segment that we'll introduce when we get to it. But we'll be back in a sec.
That's nice.
Okay. In a 3 and a 2. 1.
Blast off!
Why did it just sound like Clint had just been penetrated?
Oh, fucking A, Clint. You dirty dog.
Sorry. Couldn't help myself.
It's okay. We understand.
Oh, God.
You have needs, too.
God damn it.
All right. Back to the show.
We're going to have to do, like, a couple of drunk episodes one day.
Oh, my God.
Wait, you guys aren't drunk right now? Shit.
I'm on a car right now, so I can't drink.
I said, when you come to Nationals, you still come to Nationals?
I will do at some point. You know, when I save up enough.
Are you talking about Callum?
Both of you guys.
No, I probably won't be.
Yeah, I won't be either.
Well, I mean, not this year, but...
Oh, okay. I'm about to say, yeah, no. Jeff even asked me to come to Nationals this year. I was like, yeah, I can't.
Did you tell him to go fuck himself?
Yeah. It's like, now you're a cunt.
I actually didn't, believe it or not.
Oh.
I don't know.
Guys at IPMS Club, they're like, oh, you need to come to Nationals with us, and then the very next weekend is Oshkosh. It's like, yeah, it's like, I'm not retired like you guys.
It's like, I have a job.
The fuck is Oshkosh?
It is the world's biggest air show.
Yeah, I gotta get to fucking Oshkosh, eh? Jesus Christ. Been watching highlights of it, and it's like, when the highlight reel is like 2 hours long.
Jesus hell.
Yeah. Anyway, right. 3, 2, 1. And we are back with the hobby news, and I won't be leading this one. The others have put in some submissions, so we're gonna start with them. And first up, who put this one up?
I did. All right. Asokima Hobbies?
Aoshima.
Aoshima. Which, again, they look like...
Tamiya.
Tamiya boxes, but also Hasegawa boxes, so I'm not sure.
They follow the same box lines. It's weird.
Yeah. Like the Waterline series, Waves looks... But anyway, I'm not sure if these are
So a lot of these are new parts added in. So they're just being updated because they are fairly old, but they're just being updated. And I would love to have every single one of these. Like the wasp would be, you guys were asking how big a wasp in 700 would be. It would be, I have a feeling it might be slightly bigger than the, it would be the same size as the Hornet that I made.
So they were about, sister ships, wasn't they?
Yeah. No.
Oh.
Were they?
I always thought the wasp and the Hornet were sister ships. I could be wrong, though.
I thought they were.
You might be right.
Yeah, I've got no idea. No saying this. No.
The tower looks. The island looks different.
Okay.
Yeah. The Hornet has a very long smokestack, whereas this one, I'm not sure. Need to have a quick look because I mean they're both flying stinging insects.
Hey Callum, it's got a long what?
It's got a long what?
I know I've seen the, what is it, the Katsuragi? Katsuragi?
I've seen someone who's built one of those. It's a really interesting aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah. Very interesting camo scheme.
Yeah. Actually, no, that's what, no, someone has made one, has released a brand new one at some point. Who was it? Fuck, we featured it on an episode. Totally forgotten.
But either way, it's like, I really want to get into ships. I've been doing a lot of, I was going to say reading, but listening to audiobooks about the Pacific War and everything, and I really want to start building ships.
Dude, just try a 700 and then jump onto the 350s. The 700s are really fun to build.
I got a German 1700 destroyer that I got at a raffle a couple years ago, so I might jump in with that.
Yeah, just give it a try. I mean, you'll need to use the tweezers, but apart from that, it's not too bad.
That's essentially like the 72nd scale of aircraft for ships, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, that the Japanese seaplane tender on the top left, that would be a cool one to have.
Oh, yeah. I think I did tell you about the buddy here in town. It's like he got a little 172nd Japanese seaplane, which that's pretty much all he builds is Japanese subjects. And he was just going to build a section of the deck of the seaplane tender, and he ended up just building an entire 172nd scale seaplane tender from scratch.
Holy shit. How big would that be?
About 4 foot long.
Holy fuck!
Oh, do you have a photo of that? I'd love to see that.
He's got his own website thing that he posts his shit on. I'll find it.
I would love to see that. That would be awesome. I like that. That was just one of those things of he started building a small bit, just added a bit more and a bit more, and then oh fuck it, I take it.
Yeah, pretty much. I said he was just going to build a section of the deck to have a base for the little seaplane. And then, it just turned into he scratch-built an entire 172nd ship.
That's pretty awesome. All right, and we have even more 1 to 700s. These are all updated. And I will say box arts on these are on point. So,
oh, yeah. From especially that.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, especially the Fuso. That box art is just amazing.
I was gonna go with the Hashidate. You got the Nels in the background and the Hargos in the foreground.
Oh yeah.
But from Aoshima in the updates, we have HMS Bismarck. We have the Fuso in 1944 with metal barrels, which very welcome. And a pretty cool box art as well. You got flares going off, and you got technically the flares. They would be called star shells. Yeah, star shells. Then we have a Japanese gunboat, the Hashidate, with an awesome box art with it, and also the Nishin, which is a Japanese special purpose submarine carrier. Does that do what I think it does? Does that literally just resupply submarines and stuff on the go?
I believe so.
That is awesome. Oh, that is so cool. I want that now. That's actually, yeah, you can see in the box art, they have a submarine on the deck. Oh my god, I need that.
Oh, you'd be really cool. What? It's like, also get a couple 1700 scale submarines and have them like moored up next to the ship.
Oh, dude, would be fucking sweet.
God damn it, the amount of shit I want to build nowadays, and I just don't have the money or time to do it. It's saddening.
Most How unfortunate you consider for us
becoming
modelers.
A criminal and having the money.
I'd prefer to model a little bit with my job than not model at all in prison.
Garrison?
All right, so we've got the ICM 1 to 35th scale Darnell's Campaign of 1915 figure set. Looks like a little fire team of British machine gun crew, and then the enemy there fire team. Be a pretty cool little diorama scene there. And then Mini Art came out with this Holiday Makers, which I thought was just funny because it looks like people from like the 80s or 90s, but they've got a selfie stick and an iPhone. And
does anyone else get irrationally angry when you see someone with a selfie stick?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Especially when they pose like that. Like, just stop. Like, the couple up top is way more acceptable, even if she's doing that stupid-ass pose, versus the couple on the bottom.
It just makes you want to, like, take the selfie stick off her and just beat her senseless with it.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, that's... I think, I will say this, I think that figure set would go really good if you did, like, a diorama with a building in the center and make it, like, two scenes in one, so the left side is, like... it's all like a nice little cafe or whatever. You got the people in a car living a civilian life, and on the right side is like a war zone of the same building.
You're just stealing the fucking Andrew Measley's idea for the diorama he's doing.
Who's that?
The Kiwi guy. Diorama builder. He's doing a diorama where it's a building in the middle, like a facade, and then either side he's got like opposites.
I mean, I've seen that idea before.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the first one I saw of that was it was like a Eastern Front scene of World War II with a T-34-85 rolling past like a panzer with like a trench and the Russian or the Germans or the Russians overcoming the German position, and then the other side was like metal detector people and like digging up shit.
Oh, that's cool.
I will say that figure set would probably do well if you did say a museum diorama.
Yeah.
Do it as like the museum display or something like that.
Callum, I posted some links in podcast planning. And also, it's like if you go search his website and everything, he has like in process photos of him building.
Nice. I'll need to check those out. And I might. You think you'd be annoyed if I ripped some of his photos to check on the slide just to show people?
No, I'm sure he wouldn't mind at all.
Sweet.
As long as you give him credit for it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let it be done.
Same as Jeff Groves. It goes by Inch High Model Guy.
Oh, him. I know him. Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Yeah, hell, he lives like 6-7 minutes away from me. Oh, nice. Very nice guy.
Get him on the podcast sometime.
Yeah, dude. Seriously.
Yeah, he's retired. He's living the life. He's retired from the Navy. His wife is a doctor, and so he's Mr. Mom.
I hate dude, him already.
Yeah. Bro.
Living the
dude
life.
Is winning at life.
Yeah.
I would happily be a little house husband if I could just spend all day modeling.
Yeah, do some dishes, make some food, clean the house for like 2 hours, and then fucking model the rest of the day. Oh my god.
That's pretty much what he does. You know,
fucking lucky bastard.
Yeah. And it's like he's his entire basement, he's got a nice finished basement. That's his man cave.
Oh, I bet it is, and I bet he spends a lot of time down there.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Alright, well, moving on to the next slide, we've got from Daswerk, 1 to 35th scale German World War II flat crew set, which I think is pretty cool. I think it'd be pretty neat to do a figure set with that. and then have like an airplane flying overhead, like a 100 scale or a 70 second scale airplane flying up ahead, making like a forced perspective.
That would be cool.
And then, excuse me, on the right there, we got another kit from ICM. It's the B-26B Marauder, I think is how you say that.
Yep.
Yeah.
In 48 scale. I saw it on, I don't think it's like, it's a new kit that came out recently. I don't think it's like, it's not announcement new, but I saw it on the website and I thought it looked cool, especially the box art.
Really want this kit because I love the Marauder. There's actually fuck all in the way of Marauder kits. The only one I could get my hands on was the Airfix one. If you like self-harm and building, it was literally the worst fucking kit I've put together so far. Like, the fuselage wouldn't fit together. Like, it was very noticeable difference. Like, they wouldn't line up. It was, the canopy had, like, most of the lines for the canopy, like, structure had, like, worn off or weren't molded. So you couldn't really paint them on. It was,
That sucks. Really shit.
Yeah.
That sounds fucking miserable.
And I actually did mine as the scheme, the one that I'm just spinning around here. They called it the Big Hairy Bird or something like that. It's really, really cool. And of course, you know, it's a decal that wraps all the way around the nose. And of course, it didn't fit.
Of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next from TACOM, we're getting a whole bunch of modern ships in 350 scale. So the first up is the FFG Project 2030380, early and late productions. I have no idea what these are at all because it is modern and I don't like modern.
Yeah,
they look cool though with all that photo etch.
It does look cool though. We're also getting, especially a type the tugboat. I think these might be, I'm not, no idea where, I don't even know what these are. They just look cool. The Type 192 and the Type 192A Harbour Tugboat, which that would be Horizon Island worthy.
I think I have a picture of one of those. Hang on.
Really?
Yeah, when we're on ship, we came into port in Oki and in Guam. We had tugboats that looked damn near similar, like almost exactly like that, that pushed us into the harbor.
Cool. I was say, it's like, them look nice. I'd build them.
Yeah, and then also, multifunctional boat PR-23370 and anti-sabotage boat PR-21980, which just look like barges and little patrol boats, but they look really, really cool as well.
Anti-sabotage, is that like a minesweeper then?
I'm not sure. Like, what does anti-sabotage mean in the
regards? I don't know, modern.
I don't know modern, but especially with all the photo etch, these look pretty damn cool, and I mean, I wouldn't buy it, but if someone gave it to me, I wouldn't mind.
You hear that, folks?
Yep. Okay, ooh. Up next from Border, to complement Garrison's Das Werk 88 flak crew, we have a German 88 flak gun, flak 36, with the SSYS wagon, which means it's just on a train. This is basically a combination of two kits that are already made, put together into one to make it cool. And if you combine this with Das Werk's Flak 88 crew, I think you could make something really, really cool on this.
I wonder if the Das Werk, or not, sorry, the border lines up well with the Dragon trains.
You'd hope so. Then again, it is border, so there's definitely something, some major inaccuracy within this kit. Just going by their track record. And last week we talked about Landmo Model releasing the BA-64B Russian armored car. Well, they're also releasing it in the German captured variant. So it's the BA-64BR. This is done up in German markings, and instead of having the Soviet DT machine gun, it is fitted with either an MG-34 or 42, can't tell from the photo.
That's a 42 for sure.
Is it 42?
Yeah, it looks more squared.
Actually, it looks like it's got a weird heat shield on it. Doesn't look like either one.
Not sure what it is.
It might be a 34 with a weird heat shield.
Yeah,
probably is.
Not sure. Anyway, so something a little out there. Wouldn't mind trying some of the Lamno stuff, especially their Sherman conversions for the funnies.
Ooh, nice.
Also from Border, they have a Panzer III Ausk, but this is the command variant, so it's got a stupid fucking unpronounceable name because it's German. And all it is a Panzer III with extra radio antennas to bend and snap off.
Mm.
Either way, I wouldn't mind having one because I kind of like the Panzer III. I like it better than the Panzer IV. Hot take.
It looks really... It's like a miniature Tiger, almost. I know it's not the fucking Lux, but it just looks like a mini Tiger.
And that's all from the hobby news this week. Now we're going to move on to the whips. And who's up first?
That would be me, good sir. I've got three slides this week. I've been working on the Ukraine Yes Rex for the Republic. So this is a DML Dragon BTR-70 that I've done up as a conscript BTR-70 for the Russians. Clint here suggested I add like a burnt out tank, but I don't have anything that would work. So I pulled this from my selling stash and just took it. This entire thing, building, painting and weathering and everything, took me maybe 8 hours. Like, the kit was 7 steps and it was stupid easy to paint. But it was a lot of fun. I'm very excited to put it on the diorama.
I'd say it did a real good job doing the burnout effect.
Thank you very much. All right, next, please. Did we lose Callum?
Callum?
Did he walk away or did we lose him?
He might have walked away.
He said, yeah, fuck this BTR. But, okay, well, since he's not here, I'll talk about it a little more. I use reference photos for making this. There's going to be the word that there's no tires, I'll be burnt ash. Callum, you there, dude?
Sorry.
You good or what?
Yeah, I just had a little technological hitch. I'm good.
Oh, okay. Alright, next slide, please. Here are some Ukraine war figures. The top left is probably my favorite one. The pose is really cool. I think I did, out of all the camo patterns of multi-cam I've done, I think that one was my best. And then if you look on the right photo of that, there's an FOG flag patch on his helmet, which I really thought was pretty neat. Below that, got an AT-4, which that was really fun to do. I added the sling, the safety pin, shoulder stop, and open sights. And then top right and bottom, got 3 Ukrainians, which were glued together, so that was kind of a bitch and a half to paint. But and trying to make their uniforms vary so they don't blend together. That was fun to do as well.
I will say, the guy in the top left, out of context, kind of looks like he's jerking someone off. And looking for a third to do it.
You fucking goof.
I'm just going to plant that seed in your head, so now every time you see him on your diorama, that's all you're going to see.
I don't know, man. He's got that frag in his hand, that 67, you know? It's just...
When you go to put the one dude on the diorama to the right, make sure that, you know, you leave a blood trail behind him.
Oh, 100% will. You kidding me? The bro lost half a leg.
Hey, at least he didn't go fully to the Dan.
Yeah.
I'll be surprised if you're allowed to bring that to a model show nowadays with that amount of blood.
Oh, dude. I've got that figure with the lost leg. There's another figure, which you'll see next, that's burnt to a crisp. I've got the Grim Reaper. So this guy here is going to be next to the BTR-70. It's one of the crewmen that didn't survive. So the whole backstory, this is a conscription group for the Russians, and they use a lot of old equipment. And in Ukraine, it's kind of hard, especially if you're in a lower-tier unit, to get medevacs out. So the whole idea is that the Ukrainians have been probing this line for like a week or whatever. They destroyed the BTR a few days before. This guy died, and he's going to be covered mostly with a tarp. Since the Russians couldn't get a medevac in there. And so they'll be attacking the line, and then the Grim Reaper is going to be... I've got a Ukrainian guy that came with a skull face with a high-cut helmet, and so the Grim Reaper there is going to be getting prepared to touch him, and I'm going to use Clear Sprue and make like a bullet ricochet off the BMP-2 that the skull face guy will be sitting next to, like he's about to get killed.
Very cool. Interesting. Yes. A bit weird, but a little bit macabre.
Reality of war.
I still don't understand, like, why this guy was a bodybuilder, though. I mean, he's, like, looking there, so they're trying to flex or something.
Well, if you take a look at Tela...
Looking at this hand, it looks more like he's bragging.
If you look at Telegram, there's a lot of great reference photos for this kind of stuff. And yeah, I know it's a little dark, but if you want to make realistic shit, that's a pose very similar to that is what I based him off of. And that was the only figure I had without a shirt. So.
Okay.
Oh, Chopper!
Yeah, been working on 1-to-1 scale Chopper. I've been doing some seam filling with Milliput. And honestly, this is like as far as I've got since last week.
No, you've been busy doing other stuff.
I have been busy doing other shit. Which, next slide. Went to Indiana State Sanatorium last night. Ghost hunting or paranormal investigating, whatever you want to call it. Thing about this hospital, it shut down in 2011. It was originally built as a tuberculosis sanatorium, and then after, you know, the tuberculosis pandemic ended, it was turned into, in the 50s, they added on to it to turn into an insane asylum. And then this picture from this building was built in the 70s as a nursing home for mentally insane people. So...
So you felt right at home then?
Right at home.
It's like, hey, I used to live here.
How yeah. Horrifying.
All right, this is what I've been doing. So this is the Martin Mariner that I've been working on. So I got it all painted silver from a black base. That's the chipping layer. And put just one coat of chipping fluid on it because it's not going to be like overly chipped. Just enough. You know, just enough. And the only things I've been working on since then is I've just done painted up the engines, the two Pratt & Whitneys, and that's all glued on with the cowling, so that's had to remask all of that. And I spent most of last night painting the underside white, which is a bitch and a half. I hate painting white.
I hate painting white too, but I want to do a UN vehicle so bad.
Yeah.
Very, very light coats.
Yeah, I think it's got about 5 coats on it, just to build it up.
Jesus fuck.
Well, I do it like really thinned out, just to make sure. So it's...
Oh, yeah.
It's no, I know, but that's just a lot, dude. Bless your heart.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, once you're done, like, with one wing, you could just... The tip should be dry again, she could be able to go right back for another coat.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Basically what I was doing, it's just going back and forth over it, so, yeah. Now I've got to... Next thing is to try and mask it off. Without ripping the paint off, which is something I'm not good at.
Oh, yeah. Did you just put masking fluid over, or not masking fluid, chipping fluid over the whole thing?
Okay, so we're going to do a new segment that we're going to trial for a bit. This is the book, movie, documentary, YouTube, whatever recommendation for either modeling, military stuff, history, whatever we use to find out information relevant to what we're doing, and also just for entertainment for you all. So first up is from Clint. What have you been watching, listening, reading, whatever?
A lot of stuff, but this is a very good, I guess you call it, trilogy. it's by Ian W. Tull, and it's the Pacific War, Burke 1, Pacific Crucible, which takes place between 1941 and 1942. Then we got The Conquering Tide, which is, again, the war in the Pacific, 42 to 44. And Twilight of the Gods, 44 to 45. If you're on Audible, the first book costs you 1 Audible credit. And then the other two are free with your Audible subscription. And you really, I mean, you, yes, for the Republic. You really get, I mean, a lot of entertainment value out of this, I guess you could say. It's like book one, Pacific Crucible. It's 22 hours and 6 minutes.
Whew.
Yeah. The Conquering Tide, it comes in at 27 hours and 22 minutes. And Twilight of the Gods is 36 hours, 46 minutes.
Yeesh. Damn.
But, well, I mean, I've listened to him at work. I'm there 10 hours. So.
Hell yeah.
Definitely recommend.
And this is my recommendation. So I'm currently about three quarters of the way through a book, The Kamikaze Hunters, primarily focused on the Fleet Air Arm and the fact that the British were flying over Japan at the end of the war in Corsairs, shooting up shit and helping to contribute. They're often sort of forgotten about, but they were there. So there's a lot of information about British carriers and the creation of the FAA and what their training and stuff like that. So it was really, really interesting, especially it documents when the kamikazes started arriving to fly into shit. And there's an interesting note about the difference between British carriers and American carriers. And that's the British actually armored their carriers. The Americans didn't. And at one point, it does mean that the British carriers have a smaller capacity for carrying aircraft, but they were more survivable. There was one kamikaze that plowed into the island and of a British, I think it's the Indy, maybe, I'm not sure. But there was an American observer on the carrier, and they looked at the damage, and it took the British 45 minutes to repair it using steel plates and concrete. And, you know, next thing you know, within an hour, they're flying back again. The American observer said that sort of damage on an American carrier would mean 6 months at Pearl Harbor for repairs. So there was a lot of differences between the British Fleet Air Arm and the Americans. And so it's just really cool. It just shows you a slightly lesser known side of the Pacific War. And another recommendation is a YouTube channel, Armored Archivist. And this guy just has a shit ton of footage for a lot of Fleet Air Arm stuff, a lot of naval stuff, some really, really cool videos, some footage that you've never seen before. I've never seen before. Some you wonder how he gets it. He's got a full... One of his playlists is User Experience, and it's these documentaries with the actual pilots that flew in them, like, you know, that was recorded years ago. But, it, you know, they talk about certain aircraft, like the Fairey Firefly, the Seafires, the Hellcats, stuff like that. So it's really, really good if you want to look for references or just find out more about Fleet Air Arm stuff. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, I didn't add a slide because I wasn't thinking properly. But I've got three book recommendations. First one is "By Tank Into Normandy" by Stuart Hills. It's a really good book about a British tank commander throughout Normandy and into the end of the war. Second one is "With the Old Breed" by Eugene Sledge. If you've seen the Pacific, you already know what it is, but it's about a Marine mortarman from World War II who fought in the Pacific. Great accounts. And then the last one is probably my favorite. It's by Adam Makos. It's called Spearhead, and it's about, you know, 3rd Armored Division Spearhead going through through the war.
That is a very good book.
Very, very good book. It's the first book to actually make me tear up. So,
damn. I'm going to have to try and find it.
It's fucking good. It's a really, really good listen or read if you actually like to read. I'm autistic, so I'd like to listen. All right. Now, on to group build stuff. We've got the Micro Machines podcast, Pacific Group Build, going on until September 1st. You've still got time to enter. We have one really good prize for one winner. But But there's also a recreational submission section. So if you want to build for fun, or you've built something in the past that you want to share with others, throw it on the Discord, and we'd love to see it. Same shit, different day, except there's no prize, and this one's just for fun. It's the science fiction group build, running the same timeline, March 1st to September 1st. We've had some really cool submissions so far. But like I said, this one's just for fun, no prize.
And once you have finished listening to this episode, we encourage you to go check out all the other modeling podcasts, because they are quite different from us, but all talk about models anyway. You have stuff like Plastic Model Mojo, Plastic Posse, Small Subjects, Model Geeks, On the Bench, all that kind of stuff. We've had a couple of guests of hosts from these podcasts on, so you should go check them out. And lastly, at the very end, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Paul Gallagher, Lord Floki, Robert Judson, Robert Brisbane, and Riale Mastroni, whatever. You know who I'm talking about. You know who you are.
Sorry, buddy.
We would like to thank you for supporting the podcast, keeping the lights on, helping out however you can. It is a massive, big help. So, gentlemen, end of the episode. Any more things you want to say before we close out?
Thank you for listening. We appreciate it.
I got nothing.
Hi, Mom.
All right. If you have made it this far, thank you for listening. You have been listening to the Micro Machines podcast. We would like to thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next time talking about something, I guess.
Something.
Yeah.
Something.
But till then, we'll see you later.
Deuces.
See ya.